Thank you. It's always a good feeling coming back to the Physics Institute. My major, my PhD was done in physics, statistical mechanics. I was told there's some physics student, I don't know, there seems to be more senior people than student. If you feel bored, you can sleep. So mine is probably a little bit different from many other talks. Most people are presumably focusing on algorithm. My intention originally was to introduce this field or the work that my labs have been doing the last 5 years, gave you a broad look of the kind of biology that can be done, like a person like me coming from physics. But I have already studied a lot of biology. I just one general philosophy normally I offer to physics students that physics students tend to, you know, we're trained as physicists starting with a general principle. So generality is always the ultimate goal. So to physicists, elephant and bacterium doesn't have any difference. This is very, when you really want to do biology, I want to emphasize, you want to immerse yourself in with biologists and thinking what their concerns are. And then you'll eventually find out that biologists are more interested in specificity than generality. So even different strain of bacteria is a big deal to them, not mention the elephant or, you know. So I think
there are some biologists who are interested.
Yeah, there are.
Called the genetic code.
Right. There are few area that you can really contribute, but right now we're still in the primitive state of collecting data. It's very hard to see through what are the generality or from top-down approach. But anyway, I'm just giving some example in the field of called gene regulation. I call it genome expression regulation, just emphasize on the scale. We're dealing with many genes instead of a single gene in the traditional way. And touch upon problem in different level regulation. The first will be the RNA splicing at splicing step of regulation, and these are the translation step, classification of 5' UTR. Then the promoter problem is the regulation at the level of transcription. And if I have time, I'd just mention a little bit about recent work on comparative genomics and study of number of human genes. Some new algorithms, since I'm not focusing on specific algorithms, some algorithms working on motif will be reported next month in our Cosmic Harbor meeting. So this is a classical view or central dogma of gene expression, where information flow from DNA, RNA to protein, and regulation is in each step of this pathway. All this regulation, theme is there's cis element in DNA or RNA that interact with transfector, the proteins. So the first example I want to mention is regulation at the RNA level. We've been interested in splicing problem, especially alternative splicing. This is work done on studying a breast cancer gene. We study enhancer motifs. So these are the pattern of alternative splicing when a single gene can translate into many different proteins by alternative splice the gene into a different RNA transcript. And to understand this problem is really difficult, which not only consists of conventional classical signal, also many so-called enhancer or inhibitors that along the sequence that define, actually the sequence itself is not sufficient. It's the cell type or the concentration of the factors together with the sequence element that define a particular mode of transcription, not splicing. So this is a classical two-step biochemistry of RNA splicing, where you have first step excision at the 5' splice site, then make lyrate at branch point, and second excision step ligate the exon and release the lyrate. So these obvious, all these classical intron signals are conserved from yeast to human. Those are known many years, for many years, and this is a matrix representation of this classical motif. This particular for human, there's a pyrimidine track in front of this 3' splice site. Many people have worked in this problem, especially people who are interested in gene finding, developing algorithms to predict gene exon intron structure. These are the most important signal. This is a long history of argument, the two camps, you know, Will Gilbert intron early theory and the intron late. Just from the benefit of cell, people would argue the intron allow you to store informations there. Most people regard it as garbage, but I would say this is like evolution for bacterium. It need efficient transcription is most important, so intron get rid of during evolution. Even if you introduce intron after a few replication or generation, you will eliminate those intron. But for complex organism, evolution, it's like your physics laboratory. There are a lot of, when you look at laboratory, there are a lot of tubes that are not very efficient. That's there because history. And sometimes you may convert to some other use. And that's...
could make evolution of a protein easier.
Yeah. You have repertoire of parts.
I'm just staring at these matrices and the whole trouble parsing. So, for example, this white stuff at the end seems to have virtually no specificity.
Why
is it there as opposed to
right. Different people choose different lengths. Most people just choose this region. Some people want to, depending what kind of matrix, some people use a triplet matrix. So they need a they want to get a correlation of this base to the flanking base. They include a little bit more base from flanking region. There's no strict definition. What is the?
So is it conserved between species?
This part is. most conserved part is. But when you go to the flanking region, it looks like a species dependent. But there's still some information. It's not totally random.
Find them in random or in genomic sequence?
Oh, I think, did you talk about this?
No, I didn't talk about this.
I thought probably somebody already talked about this already. If you take this part only, so 4 to the 9th, that's how often you would expect roughly. In the genome, but it occurs pretty often, especially when you have long intron. There are a lot of sites that match this. Obviously, the specificity of itself is not sufficient. There are also higher order structure that will guarantee those cryptic sites, called cryptic sites, are not exposed at the time of splicing.
Maybe one answer to your question, of course. When you say how many sites there are, that depends on what kind of threshold you use for the score. But if you set the threshold low enough that you capture 90% of the true sites, you usually end up with 5 to 10 times more false sites. So the specificity is not very good if you have high sites.
Right. But many of those foresights are not proven foresight. Maybe some of them are really get used at some exotic conditions. It's difficult. So in all this field, you can't rule out absolutely anything. You can only say this occur more often. Even this A doesn't have to be absolutely conserved. You know, people have one example. Anything can happen in biology.
Is there a difference between length distribution for neutrons close to 5 and neutrons distribution? If you look at different neutrons in different positions, are there lengths different? General,
what do you mean close to 5' and 3'? Right, in human there are many exons. What do you mean there's no particular preference? Yeah.
I don't think there's any. I think he's asking us are the 5' ones shorter than the 3'?
5' exon in average shorter than the 3' exon. Yeah. Intron 5' exon is in average longer than the 3' intron, but there's no systematic study. It's just empirical. I think intron length is not very important. People have changed intron length, and it doesn't matter. It's spliced correctly. So I'm mainly interested in the things called exonic splicing enhancer, which are the signals motif in the exon region. Of course, they're also in the intron. Those are more difficult to discover. Recently, people are starting to investigate intron enhancer too. But here, I'm only focusing on exon enhancer. These tend to be the binding site for a whole class of protein called SR protein. The general structure is they have RS domain in reach of arginine and serine and has RNA binding domain. And there's a theory called exon recognition theory, especially for higher eukaryotes like human. Exon is very short, intron very long. How the splicing machinery recognize small exons given there are many cryptic sites along the sequence. And this theory says there are signals in the exon and flanking the exon, so it makes splicing machine bridge across an exon and recognize exon first before bring different exons together, start splicing. And that idea has been proven by chemistry and genetics over the years. Basically, it's correct when you have long intron system. So these are the idea where there are many splicing factors. So each of these factors has this RS domain. RS domain plays the role of protein-protein interaction. It'll increase specificity, although each element may be not very specific. So here I list some known member of this class, and this one is discovered simultaneously at Spring Harbor and Columbia. And later, there are many other members of this family are discovered.
How much does this recognition constrain the exons themselves? Can you feed any exon and do something that you recognize?
What do you mean? You
you just have to glob onto the exons, have to find the exons.
Right.
And are there any biases on which codons they prefer or such things? Or just,
Obviously coding, if you're talking about coding exon, the codon is the most important constraint. Then all the other enhancer has to be secondary, but still there are many ways to make such secondary signal that I'll show the example today, a single motif is enough. Single mutation is enough to destroy that enhancer. But in general case, you take several of these weak motif to get specificity. But you can swap exons, still splicing machinery will recognize exon. Also intron, you can also swap using some other intron, you'll get splicing. So there are definitely some signals in there. So the idea is to use a biochemical method called SELECT, basically to select binding motif. You make a random RNA library. So you randomize this region in your library and using each specific SR protein you're interested in to do run each many round of selection under this substrate. So this is a mini gene in S100 extract. This has the property that it requires SR protein as well as exonic splicing enhancer in order to have splicing. So this is called functional selection. There are another set of select method they select for binding. So there often you'll see the motif that select by binding assay is different from by the functional assay. This is functional assay. Binding is not enough. You have to see splicing taking place. You have the result in a splicing product. So we did this in collaboration with the splicing laboratory, did a select experiment for a series SR protein and find their binding site. They have common, the common property is they're very short and not very specific. So that just tell you, you probably need multiple of them in reality. Then we start using those matrix, we start scan some mutation database. One example was found in the BRCA1, the cancer gene exon 18. People have reported that there's a single missense mutation from G to T. You destroy this codon into a stop codon. Then this exon gets skipped. And there's a famous pathway called nonsense mediate decay, NMD, and that means whenever you make error mutation, you make missense mutation, there is a surveillance machine that scans through the transcript. When you have premature stop codon, it will send this transcript into a degradation pathway. Some protein will come and degrade this transcript. That's a famous pathway worked out by many laboratories, and people suspect this may be one of those. And we're interested in another mechanism that's this mutation actually destroy enhancer. So we did the following experiment too. This is the wild type and the mutant. So using our scores, we can create another missense mutation here and still maintain high score of the motif, or create a sense mutation, but destroy basically motif, gave low score. So when you do the splicing, as you expect, you can rescue this mutant, but you can't. So it proved that this single mutation actually destroyed the enhancer or the RS protein binding site. So this disease actually was caused at the splicing level instead of most people now looking at a SNP, especially the codon, so-called coding SNP, they always assume this SNP, the mutation result in the protein truncation or the change of the codon, so change the function of the protein. And this is a new mechanism that change actually at the RNA step. So people in medical school now using this method to scan many of the mutation in the database, disease mutation database, trying to find other examples. These are some other experiment. We create artificial sequence where you have high motif scores, and you can also rescue that exon. We later did a systematic study of a cancer mutation database and find many genes record document mutation where we list the arrow down means destroy a motif, arrow up means create a new motif because of the mutation. And we did a not very sophisticated statistical analysis, and this is there are over there's more significant destroy these functional sites then create new sites. So we predict many of these mutations actually result at aberrant splicing. So recently we submit a paper, we design website to collect SR protein binding motif matrix and scan, allow user to scan their sequence or genome so they can use our website to generate a plot like this for each their interest factor. We plan to expand this database to include other SR protein or some other splicing factors.
Did you pick up these missplice things in EST databases? Or did you use exon skip transcripts in EST databases, or are
they
too rare?
We didn't look at EST database. EST database is not very clean. There are a lot of problems with EST database. We look at the disease mutation database. That's more well curated. Oh, the alternate splicing. Yes, you're right. The mostly alternate splicing naturally used as a tissue-specific to produce tissue-specific transcript. Yeah, but you do see some alternate splicing occur in the same cell. So actually, this ratio of different transcript that controlled physiology of the cell. So it's important. So all of the current array missed this, cannot detect the relative abundance of different alternative isoforms. That's why we started this collaboration with the UCSD people and Illumina. We designed so-called splicing chip. We put specific splicing junction on the chip, detect specific splicing variant. We currently screening cancer cell libraries and trying to detect cancer cell specific transcript, and also this will help us to improve our prediction. We can predict some alternative junction and test on the chip, see if we can see. So this is ongoing, supported by NCI. No. Splicing is only one step of regulation. There are transcription level that are more important, and I think there should be some other speaker talking about this. Yeah.
In terms of splicing,
yeah.
So alternative splicing between different tissues is the major explanation for that.
And also different developmental stage also. Yeah. No, it's not close to exhaustive. I'm sure there are many others. Yeah. And also we build this alternative splicing database, and when we get new data, we can update our database. Our database is one of the few databases that actually document only experimentally mapped. Instead of, there are many databases that use EST alignment to compute alternative splicing. Okay, I have to move on. This second example is the regulation at translation level. Translation was mostly regulated at 5' UTR and 3' UTR. I don't know if people know what is UTR. Okay, when you have mRNA transcript, after splicing, you have mature mRNA, then the coding region is called CDS coding, and outside of coding region called untranslated region, UTR. So there is 5' UTR, 3' UTR. So, but at genomic level, the 5' UTR can have introns at genomic sequence. Okay, some people, even biologists, confuse the term. You know, they sometimes they call anyways, if you look at GenBank sequence, you have to be very careful. The annotation, there are lots of mistakes. So one take-home lesson is that, especially for students when you want to work in this field, if you're not biologist or doing experiment, it's very important to get clean, correct data. All the analysis is secondary. I think once you get the data, 80% of the job is done. And if you have a garbage data, no matter how powerful your algorithm, you're not going to get a good result. So we try to get clean result. This was motivated by our latest work. We're really interested in the promoter. In order to get promoter, we have to know where the transcription start site is. That means we have to know where the 5' UTR is. At that time, there are very few complete cDNA sequence in the public database. So we need to get enough complete cDNA in order to map transcription start site. So we decide to launch this project before our promoter study. So we try to identify the best laboratory that can get a full-length cDNA. We identify this lab, Sugano lab at University of Tokyo. He was using a very complicated biochemistry, basically decap the 5' cap, then put linker and sequence out from the 5' end. So most of his sequence really complete at 5' end. When you look at GenBank cDNA, there are many sequences that are truncated at 5' end because those sequences starting from 3' and using poly-DT as primer to reverse transcriptase, those transcriptase tend to fall off in the middle when you have long genes. So almost all the time you don't get the full length cDNA. So we get a clean set of 5' or 5' UTR sequence. We're interested to identify, classify such 5' UTR sequences. Originally, we thought classification of 5' UTR sequence will automatically induce classification of promoter sequence as well. It didn't turn out that way, but still very useful. There are several known regulatory sequence in the 5' UTR region, like secondary structure or upstream ORF or putative or upstream AUG. Actually, these AUG often get used during the translation. So ribosome bind to this start to translate from this upstream AUG and fall off. So this way you can control the speed of rate of translation, real translation start site is here. And there are also other signal called internal entry site, and these occur. So the ribosome doesn't have to start from here, it can entry right from here. And these are some document example. At that time, we collect many of the document example and try to classify according to biological knowledge. So we identify three class. These are the known member of the class. So altogether, over 300 sequences. The first class is translationally repressed mRNA. That means it's highly regulated. Originally, we were trying to find highly translated and low translated. There are two class. Already, when people studying yeast, they identify there are two classes, highly translated and lowly translated. And these are related to the codon usage. One can think because the tRNA abundance will affect the rate of translation. We want to test that idea in the human and the mouse also. So, but there, in the human case, we find additional class, second class, because they all have 5' terminal oligopyrimidine track, called 5' top. These are consist of top mRNA. They're mostly ribosomal RNA. This translation is regulated in a growth-dependent manner. Then they're efficiently translated. So then we learn, we ask many biologists, what are the highly translated genes? There seems to be no highly translated, the default default mode is the so-called Heidi translate. Any regulation tend to be negative to try to reduce the rate of translation. So we use this known number using standard classification tool and using this quality data set to build a classification tree. The particular method is CART, developed by Stanford and Berkeley group statisticians. So this CART is very similar to a similar tree algorithm in computer science. They call C3 point something. But the basic idea is to generate a full tree, then train back and do validation using statistical validation and stop at the level where you have enough support element in each of the nodes. And this algorithm allow you to throw in many feature variables. Suppose you don't know which one feature variable are most important. So in this case, we throw in 12, I think, variable, and you only retain the 4 or 3 and rank them according to which one is the most important and which is second important and so on. So it's very flexible classification tool. Once you use the known member and build this classification tree, then we apply this to the rest of the unknown 5' UTR sequence, or many biologists came to us want to classify his sequence using this tree. It becomes trivial matter once you have this.
What is delta G there?
It's the folding. When you fold 5' UTR sequence using Michael Zucker's RNA folding program. Is that taught in this workshop? But there's RNA folding algorithm that calculate the free energy change, the fold, compared to the free, and that's one of the most important parameters. Actually, that correlates to the secondary structure, as you might be able to imagine.
So for the highly translated genes, are there countdown selections?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that. So this is the cross-validation of this classification method on the data. It did pretty good job on the known data. When you do 10 cross-validation, each time you take a certain percentage of the data to train the algorithm and classify the other, I think 2/3 to build a tree and classify 1/3. So this is some of the conclusion. The top one is delta G is the most discriminant variable for the tree classification, and followed by these other feature variable. And as Holly mentioned, this we test these. The most surprising thing is this: the codon usage and expression level in human genes are not correlated. We specifically test this, and also we test on the mouse, have the same conclusion. So this is one of the surprises that came out from this study. It seems to be 5' UTR sequence. Presumably there are also signals in 3' UTR sequence we haven't now studied, also contribute to the translational regulation. But codon usage is not important for human mouse.
Do you have any sense as to how these C3 classifiers work versus the HLM?
We haven't tried that. Yes, you can.
Do you have a sense of the pros and cons of
No. I was like I said in the beginning, getting a good data set is the most important. There are many algorithms that are equivalent, almost you get equivalent result, doesn't matter which algorithm you use. Some get slightly better, but again, genomic data are noisy, so a slight improvement doesn't really mean the algorithm is always better. I want to finish up this transcription regulation. So promoter, I don't know if Gary talked about promoter. Oh. Okay. Promoter is a sequence that you know, the 5 prime end of the gene to transcription of star site. Then there are typically have the Tata box signals at minus 30, you know, it's from the star site. Then there are initiator right at star site, and there's some downstream element. Not every gene have all the element, but experimental evidence seem to suggest that at least 2 of these 3 elements has to be there to define a core promoter. And that's where this initiation complex initiate. So the definition of core promoter is the region where the initiation complex binds, and experimentally they can operationally define by about 100 base pair sequences. That means if you put this 100 base pair with any downstream gene, the transcription star site, the polymerase will bind precisely at that position and start transcription. And then there are upstream called enhancer or regulatory element. It can be very close. These closer ones sometimes called proximal promoter element. Then there are enhancer that are far away. So definition of the enhancer actually is it can occur any place. It doesn't matter which position or even orientation. You can change orientation. Those are very difficult to identify. So most promoter study people are concentrating on near so-called proximal promoter. So it's about 1 kb near the transcription star site. But obviously, if you study developmental biology, those enhancers far away are most important because these are direct the differentiation or development, and especially like a locus control element in the beta globin gene control a whole big region, and depending on fetal or adult, it turns on different globins, and those elements are really difficult to identify.
A lot of people argue the lot of eukaryotic DNA is junk DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got those repetitive sequences which enable those distant enhanced elements to bend over, maybe it's not junk DNA.
I don't believe they're junk DNA. Yes. You just don't know what the function are. Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. Right.
But if it's food green, the fish gets away without it.
Right.
The problem.
But at least they play some structure role. They fold up into chromatin and connect to the matrix. You know, the higher order control is actually pretty important for eukaryotes. That control which region gets open, and that cannot be determined by this so-called proximal element. Those are determined by higher order or long-range interaction. So I think we're still far away from that. Okay, but I just want to give a quick overview of the basic methodology to identify the study promoter problem. There are ways called de novo. That means you have to build a data set, then train using known example and come up with algorithms that can predict where the promoter is and specifically predict where the transcription star site is. And the second category of methods called functional genomics, using expression or localization data to predict a cis element, this regulatory element. The third method, most recently people use comparative genomics. Once you have a related species, and it's the integrate or all different methods that people have used to attack this problem. I'll give you example from each of these category. So some of early work was these so-called de novo prediction. So we have core promoter program that only uses signal about 100 base or so. Without going into details, like I said, this element, Tata box initiator, a downstream element, are important, and we roughly know their position. So we want to decompose this region by windows and studying characteristic word frequency in different window position and use this information to build classification tool to make prediction. So there are many tools you can use. In this particular work, we use a quadratic discriminant. But as I said, it doesn't matter. You can use HMM or some other techniques or trees. So the typical output would be for this gene, you'll get a prediction of transcription star site and the relative score. And this algorithm is useful because it only takes input of 2 KB sequence. So it's not designed to scan the whole genome. You get a lot of false positives because all the training data are this only in this region. So this originally was designed for biologists. Many biologists, they study promoters, so they clone their promoter in a 2 KB, a few KB region, and they sequenced that, and they came to us as to help them identify transcription star site. And this is good for so-called fine structure mapping. And there are other tools that are better for large scale. For example, this CPG promoter we developed later. This CPG island was well known in mammalian or in vertebrates. There are a lot of CPG dinucleotide enriched in the 5' region of each gene, most of the human gene. We identify about close to 70% of human gene has this so-called CPG-rich regions. So those originally used biologists just as a rule of thumb to identify the beginning of the gene. So we want to quantify this notion. So we use a CPG island prediction program to predict all the CPG island. Then we do classification and decide which CPG island are really correlated to the promoter or transcription star site. So this algorithm can work on a very large sequence, you know, 50 KB or 1 megabyte. So I think one need to define tool working on different scales. It's like if you sitting on an airplane, you want to locate a region, you see a large landscape, then you use other tool to do a fine mapping. So maybe molecular recognition is also that way, different scale using different features. We should build our tool according to that principle. So one can, for example, use a large scale mapping tool in conjunction with that fine scale mapping. This one map the CPG island, these are CPG island, these are CPG island related promoter. Then you can use core promoter, take this region and to like zoom in to see which one of these actually has transcription star site. It's a two-step discrimination process. And as I alluded to, my group are interested in studying not just promoter, also the first exon problem. First exon is the first exon consists of two types. One is has partially coding region. There are also another type, about 40% gene. First exon is totally non-coding. There's no coding sequence. Those first exon are very difficult to identify. No gene finding program are able to predict those exons. So we thought, since we want to study promoter problem, we might as well just study first exon problem all at once. So we'll get first intron and also promoter as a byproduct, because most of the promoter element not only occur in the promoter region, they're also in the first intron region. And once you correlate it to the signal across exon, you may get better recognition. So without going to, these are all published results, you can read the paper, but the bottom line is we built a first exon recognition program, and we compare the byproduct, the promoter prediction, to a commercial, the best commercial promoter prediction program, and get some summary of statistics. We also run on finished genome chromosome 21 and 22 using a known gene in those large chromosomes to calibrate our prediction accuracy.
Sorry, I missed some biology. So what is first exon?
First exon, okay. First exon starts from transcription start site to the first intron boundary. Yeah.
But you said that it's not coding?
It doesn't have to be coding. Codon, you know, ATG could start on second exon or third exon.
It would be UTR.
Right. That means the whole sequence is part of UTR, non-translated region.
Exon by definition is translated.
Yeah, many biologists make that mistake. This is not, it's okay. So when you read GenBank sequence, you be very careful. There are a lot of annotations are wrong. They said this is 5' UTR. When you read this is ATG star, then you can throw that away right away. That means they don't know what they're talking about.
Part of the confusion is that essentially, all the gene finders only try to predict the coding region.
Right. That makes biologists think.
But in fact, the exon, by definition, must extend upstream of the AAV. Mm-hmm. The exon is the part of the transcribed RNA that gets retained in the final.
Right. Vaccine. Most gene prediction programs do not attempt to predict transcription start site. So they only list the coding exons. So when you run those programs, you have impression that the first exon is, you know, just coding. First exon, there are more exons. Yeah.
So for the promoter, about half of them are associated with CPGNN. Has anybody been able to make progress on the other half, which is not associated with CPGNN?
No one is making progress. This is a hard problem. And if someone young would like to study, okay, I'm actually looking for someone to study this problem. That's the next step. Very hard. I think there are two problems. One is hard. The other one is we don't have enough data at that time. Most people, all these sequences up to now, sequence gene are more or less using CpG island to identify their genes. Now we have genomic sequencing, so that gave us unbiased data. If you look earlier genes, those are cloned using the CpG island information. So the training data is biased that way. So now we have unbiased data, there's a chance that we have enough knowledge to study what's going on for the non-CpG island related genes. Okay, this is just a website that people can run our program or if they don't want to download. More recently, we used the first exon prediction in conjunction with the mRNA information, try to annotate the whole human genome and the mouse genome, because there, if you have first exon prediction, then you find some of the prediction actually inside of the mRNA or gene prediction, then you can rule out as false positive. So by combining mRNA or EST information, you can improve first exon prediction. That's basically the idea. I don't want to go into too much detail. And this also allows us to identify alternative promoters. Right now, if you run our program, we operationally define alternative promoter when we have two first exon prediction, there are at least 400 base pair apart, because there are genes, many genes, they have multiple star sites. They are controlled by a single promoter. And in order to have real independent first exon controlled by a separate promoter, they really have to have some minimum distance. What is the correct minimum distance? We don't know right now. We just define has to be larger than 500. Many genes, actually, the precise star site is not important. It's the whole distribution around that. So in that case, the precise position is not really important. So in the promoter or transcription star site prediction business, if you can predict transcription star site within 100 base pair window, you're done. There's nobody require you to precisely predict. Normally, only for those genes that has very strong Tata box that has precise transcription star site, 30 base downstream. Otherwise, you can have multiple star site.
There are genes, probably a lot, that have multiple transcription star sites. Do your program take those into consideration?
We cluster all the transcription star site within 500 base pair and regard it as a single exon. Then anything larger than 1500, we report as a separate potential alternative first exon. But you have to do experiment to verify whether it's correct or not. Okay, this paper has just submitted. So once it's published, this will be available to the public. People can log in to see our mapping of transcription, all the first exon annotation in the human. We're currently working on mouse and a rat. Eventually, they're all going to be put on the web. And we also have map on the Celera sequence. So if you have a Celera database, you can also see the prediction there. So currently, we're in collaboration with the experimental lab within Cosmic Harbor, try to verify our first exon prediction, develop a high throughput experimental protocol. So basically going like this, we predict first exon and develop a whole suite of experimental protocol, try to optimize using large scale format, which large scale means 96 well format for biologists, and using whole of this method and to confirm or validate our prediction and go round and round, improve our prediction. And hopefully in this process, we'll also discover novel genes. And this grant has submitted, we don't know what the fate. We just generated preliminary results. And the data we use for initial tests are these different categories. The first one, EPD, eukaryotic promoter database, they are well characterized as a positive control. Then we use RefSeq, they are almost full-length cDNA. Then we use gene prediction with some EST, and next level, only single EST. All these categories are not in public prediction. If you look at Ensemble or Celera or public annotation, they don't regard this as real genes. So there are a lot of potential to discover novel genes from this category. So we make a first 96 well to test this and see how the prediction works, how the experimental protocol works. Then there are functional genomic methods. This is the earliest work we in collaboration with Bruce Fulcher at Cold Spring Harbor and Brown Boston Lab at Stanford. We were studying cell cycle regulation. Probably most people know this. I don't want to go to detail. You just measure cell cycle progression of using microarray. Then you can cluster them and identify periodically oscillated genes and cluster using any clustering algorithm. You get a different cluster at different phase. Then using promoter prediction program, take those co-regulate gene and look at the promoter and try to identify promoter element. One of the famous element were identified in that paper is called MCM1 and SFF. Then this later proof is a binding site for two fuckhead proteins, 1 and 2. And originally geneticists missed this, could not clone this because the redundancy. Whenever you have a two factor that are redundant pathway, if you knock out one, it still functions, so it's hard to identify. Once we know the binding site, people knock out both factor and rerun the array, you see the regulation for that cluster deregulating. That's this cluster here. Then people further characterize by genetic and biochemical mean and prove that the long sought factor was a pair of forecast proteins. And we'll also extend the work on human and mouse use one of the famous cell cycle transcription factor E2F. So we build a recognition algorithm, try to using microarray data to identify E2F. E2F not only play role in G1 to S phase, it also play role in the G2 phase. We identify some motif, and experimenters are still in the process validating some of the motif. And I think this already Rin talked about, so I don't want to talk more. So this is another method I mentioned, is called localization using Crimpton IP method. You can identify binding site on large scale. This was done by Ren on the E2F to identify E2F binding site on the large, you know, genomic scale. So the current, PCR confirmation of some of the identification. Current challenge is how to integrate expression data and chromatin IP data and promoter sequence data. Integration of these three data sets will be a powerful approach. Some of our lab postdoc students working on exactly this problem. People will report next month, the meeting report, how to evaluate exactly the p-value. We have two motifs. Allow overlap. Most of the calculation of statistics ignore the motif overlap. We try to get exact p-value for the overlap case. Also, we study so-called composite site. I think probably Gary talked about their algorithm to identify two motifs. We also developed two algorithms. It's going to be reported next month to how to identify, you know, two motifs using this kind of data. Lastly, I just, I don't have time, 5 minutes, is that all right? Okay. I just want to mention a most recent trend that comparative genomics become a very important tool. So whenever you want to apply a grant, if you say you want to apply a grant, I want to do gene predictor or something, you don't mention comparative genomic, you're tossed away in the garbage right away. So in this field, everything moving very fast. You're shooting at a moving target. You have to identify what are the data available now, not then, and design your plan and algorithm to take into account today's data or even future's data. This one exercise we started in collaboration with Harvard group and Stanford to study a region using human and mouse homology. This class of protein called protein cadherin genes. These are neuronal surface molecule. They actually specificity is on the surface. This molecule specify which kind of cell talk to what other kind of cell. This has been an outstanding problem in neuroscience. People try to figure out there are so many different cell type. How could the self organize itself talking to the right neighbor? There's self organization. So we believe that there are random. I'll talk about that later. So this molecule actually specifies specificity. They revolutionized the new way of looking at the neuroscience problem. These are the some of the surface molecule. The class I'm talking about is this one, protocadherin family. They have a variable external region and a constant. They all have same region inside the cell, and they have motif called fin motif. Actually, all these are originally identified by two hybrid systems using fin as bait. So identify the cDNA and clone the cDNA. We are studying genomic sequence. The structure at the genomic level, there are three clusters, and these are genes, alpha genes, that have three constant exon and a variable first exon. There are a lot of them. They cover a very huge region, and these are paralogous regions. These gamma and alpha are most similar. They all have constant region. This one doesn't. And this is a causal look of this, and the size, you know, cover a couple hundred KB. It's very difficult to for genetic study to study large clones. And this is the phylogenetic relation. If you translate those CDN coding region and plot phylogenetic relation, you will see these orthologous genes are most closely related as opposed to paralogous genes. We're interested in the promoter region, so we hypothesize that in the promoter region, we should also see this effect. So when you calculate pairwise conservation, the orthologous conservation should be much higher than paralogous. That's the case here also. Actually, originally, people don't know whether this gene was processed by alternative promoter. They could be processed by transplicing, alternative splicing, or many other ways. And in order to test whether each one is alternative first exon, we look for promoter item, and here is a human mouse comparison. You see the conserved region in front of each of these first exon, and we identified this conserved element in front of putative promoter region. Most recently, I think a Harvard group actually experimentally validated this motif are real. They are functional. So it's most likely these are alternative promoters. Still, a question is open whether these alternative first exon are brought to the constant exon by alternative splicing or transplicing.
Yes.
Yes. But it's an alternative or transplicing is still not proven because this intron is huge. Making these contracts clone is difficult. And we identified two very conserved large elements inside that intron, in between the first variable exon and the constant exon. This conserved signal could serve as transplicing signal. So we suggest a Harvard group to try to use this information to prove whether there are intermediate splicing product. So just 1-2 minutes. Most recently, we did a human and mouse comparison. We were competing with the mouse consortium group to publish this information. We use not only the public mouse genome, also the Celera. The middle is the ensemble gene. I think one of these is public, one is a Celera. So we identify all the conserved sequence element, build conserved sequence element database. This is going to be very useful for looking for novel genes or conserved regulatory elements and things like that. And you can see from this example where public may miss one region and Celera may miss another. So you really need both genome to identify to have complete picture. And these are on the website. This has been published together at the same time, I'll say, with the public mouse consortium. And this is a look at the newly published affymetrix data. They affymetrix using genomic tiling of chromosome 22. So every 100 base or so tile on the chip. So they use many different CDN library to hybridize to look at the transcription region. So whenever we have a hybridization signal, that means that sequence is covered by a transcript. So AFI, using that method, identified 10 times more transcript region than all EST library together. So we want to look at our conserved sequence element density along the chromosome 22 comparing to Sanger annotation of non-coding gene density, and also reported AFI metrics and this region, there are many over-represented transcribed region in AFI. So I talked to AFI people. They're currently trying to validate what are these. There are a lot of transcripts. They're not protein coding genes. They're just RNA. They're transcribed. Nobody knows what they are, what's the function are. So right now, this is a big mystery. we know already there are a lot of short RNA, functional RNA play a role in RNA interference. Those are 20, 30 base, but the one majority of RNA they identify is around 100 base or so. They don't know what they are. It takes quite a bit of work to validate their prediction. There's their cytoplasma polyadenylated. These they are sure. Okay. They're polyadenylated and also transported to cytosol. They make sure that. Still, they don't know what are they. They don't look like. If you look at RECON-D cDNA library, RECON did a lot of mouse cDNA sequencing. A lot of them are also similar nature. They're not protein coding gene. Nobody knows what they are. Maybe they're functional. Who knows? So we also use this conserved information using two basic assumptions using chromosome 20, 21, and 22, these three finished genome at that time, assuming these conserved element are correlated or are correlated to the gene density as I showed in the previous slide, and also assuming these three chromosomes together behave similar to the whole genome. These are two basic assumptions. Once you have this assumption, you can derive expected number of genes, lower bound and upper bound. These are all lower bound, actually. There are genes, people originally, Solera and public predict there are 30,000 genes, and many people like John Hopkins and claim there are 70,000, there are more because they use SAGE library or some other cDNA sequencing. They find a lot of EST, SAGE, tags. There may be many other, or Affymetrix also identify many transcribed region. Most of them are probably alternative splice exons. So at least this is consistent. We don't see using mouse and human comparison, we don't see there are more genes to be discovered than there are. But there's, so in terms of novel genes, there are probably 10,000 novel genes still out there. So all the drug company and people, gene hunters are developing technology trying to get the last 10,000. This is only if you look ortholog. Right, when you depend how you define conserved element, you can vary E value. Right. So different stringency, you get different lengths of conserved element. I just want to show this does not depend on the cutoff, how you define the conserved element. It's not does not depend on very much. This is total gene number estimate. This is only look at the extrapolate from non-homologs. Using the annotated non-homologs, this is the lower bound. There are many genes than non-homologs. Okay, thank you. These are the people of my lab. Yeah, Liang.
In your current work where you classify the transcription current, in experimental data, does the transcription always start at the same site? Or are there cases when it starts here and there?
You mean translation?
Transcription start.
Oh, transcription start. Yeah, it can have different. Both transcription and translation can have different start site.
In the data, there's some distribution of transcription start site.
Yeah.
So that means that the promoter, you don't really know. There's no promoter signal.
There is promoter signal. It's just some promoter signal define transcription start site precisely. Some promoter signal do not define precisely. That means cell tolerate different start site. As long as you translate to correct protein, it doesn't care. It doesn't want to spend more energy, try to make more. It's like a manufacturer. If you customer happy, you don't want to spend more money to try to get more precise. But for some genes, you have to. The customer requires you. You must have given me more. Okay. Then you have to have more apparatus to make sure that you get a single transcription star site. And cell does that too. Yeah, gene specific. Yeah. Thank you.